Roger Williams University is hosting a crisis management seminar on May 3rd at their Providence campus. Crises, whether a natural disaster, cyber attack, or financial instability, can have severe repercussions if not handled properly. This is where crisis management plays a pivotal role. Join Roger Williams MBA students and expert speakers to learn how to prepare for the unexpected. The program is totally free and open to the public. You can register online at rwu.edu/events/crisis-management-symposium.
This is the Bartholomew Town Podcast.
Welcome to another edition of the Bartholomew Town Podcast. I'm your host, Bill Bartholomew. From our Providence, Rhode Island studios, I sit down with political science professor Wendy Schiller. Dr. Wendy Schiller is the chair of Brown University's Political Science Department and is also a frequent contributor to local and national media outlets, providing distinct commentary on issues of politics, policy, and government. With the 2018 election cycle in the rearview, I wanted to get Dr. Schiller's big-picture takeaways and impressions on how she sees Rhode Island and national politics developing in the coming year. You may find each of my in-depth conversations with Rhode Island politicians, media members, artists, and beyond on Apple Podcasts or BartholomewTown.com. I had a lot of fun talking politics with Dr. Schiller, someone who I was very much looking forward to having on the program, and I led the conversation off by asking her how she ended up in Rhode Island.
Well, I came to Rhode Island in the fall of 1994 to take a job as an assistant professor of political science at Brown University. I had worked in Washington after college in the U.S. Senate, and I'd worked for Governor Cuomo of New York. Mario, the father, not the son. And then I went to graduate school, and then I ended up at Brown teaching politics, and I've been here ever since.
That's really fascinating. I didn't realize you'd worked for Governor Cuomo. I don't know too much about him other than the what you'd read in like a Bill Clinton biography, but I did see one of the greatest things I ever experienced in my life was a debate at Cooper Union moderated by Tim Russert between Mario Cuomo and Newt Gingrich. And I left there thinking, wow, there are smart people across the spectrum, even if they say and do detestable things on the right-hand side sometimes, or even on the left. Do you feel like that academic version of politics that Mario Cuomo, to me anyway, presented was sort of what informed your...
Well, I think there are strains of Mario Cuomo in Barack Obama in his speech making ability. I think the 1984 Democratic National Convention speech where Mario Cuomo gave the keynote to nominate Walter Mondale was his real breakout moment. And then when I worked in politics, I worked for Senator Dan Patrick Moynihan on the Senate side, and then I went to work for Cuomo. And it's funny, Tim Russert worked for both Mario Cuomo and Moynihan. Moynihan first, then Mario Cuomo. So he was familiar with both of them. And Newt Gingrich came along, and we sort of knew who he was. Trent Lott was the guy from Mississippi, kind of like Newt Gingrich, but he went to the Senate in 1988 and left the House to Newt Gingrich, who was a PhD in history and a college professor of history. So he was always thought to be smart, never underestimated. Right. And I think speech making and communication is a really important factor in being able to connect. We saw that Governor Raimondo did very well in her reelection campaign, but for so long, the issue there was that people in Rhode Island didn't feel as though they connected to her in some way. And similarly with Obama, he was really great on the campaign trail. And then in the first couple of years as president, he lost that connection with people. He wasn't his campaign self. And you can see where that when the agenda gets really heavy and there's a lot of heavy lifting to do, presidents or governors get very serious about things and they can't make as lofty speeches as they did. But it's a fundamental component of American politics that you have to be able to connect. And if you can't connect at the most visceral level, then it becomes a harder sell when you want to get people's votes.
Yeah, it certainly would explain Donald Trump's ascension to the presidency is, unfortunately, his brand of communication appealed to enough people that he was able to get in.
Well, I mean, I think you can be a Republican and think, I want the Republicans to keep the White House, you know, win the White House back and run the country. And his policies, frankly, really are the GOP policies for the last decade. There isn't a lot of daylight between what Donald Trump wants to do and what the Republican Party has said that they want to do when they were in the House and controlled the Senate, but not the White House. Once you get into control of the White House and unified party government, which only lasted a little bit of time, 2 years, then you have to deliver. And I think the Republicans found found it much more difficult to deliver because Donald Trump wasn't really that committed to their policies and was too unpredictable and unstable, I think, to be powerful and make use of those first 2 years. So the irony, if you want to call it that, is that Obama had the Democratic Congress for 2 years. He had a unified party government, and he got, obviously, among other things, the Affordable Care Act through and the stimulus package and the bailouts for the auto industry and the insurance industry, and he did a lot of things. Some people say he didn't do enough, but he did a lot. And then he lost control of the House, same thing as Donald Trump, but he won re-election in 2012. And Bill Clinton won re-election in 96. And that's why I think the Democrats face an uphill climb in ousting Donald Trump, even despite his negative approval ratings, which stay stuck essentially below 50% at about 41 or 42% on a good day. That is not an indicator that he won't win re-election again. The question is his style of communication wearing thin? That's the big question mark, because you saw that in the midterm elections in competitive districts where Republicans usually do pretty well, they lost seats, not just because they retired and they were open, but because they were incumbents who were carrying the Trump baggage. And that's a bit of an indicator that the people who voted for Trump in 2016 may not be as willing to vote for him again in 2020. But if he pivots and changes his style and his rhetoric, it, you know, it's always possible.
Certainly, Nikki Haley is the, you know, the X factor as well. Can she be added to a ticket that would then, you know, reel back in a little bit of those suburban female voters that right now you just have to imagine anecdotally, by and large, couldn't support the rhetoric?
I think the suburban female voters deserted the Republican Party in droves. I mean, it was a stampede away from the Republican Party. And that, you know, Trump won 53% of college-educated women, and he lost by, you know, more the bigger gender gap than 2016. I mean, the Republicans lost with women. So, yes, I think it's a huge factor. I think, and I think he's aware of it. I don't think it's an accident that Nikki Haley is no longer UN ambassador. I think, you know, you sort of have to get out of that fray if you want to be, you know, floating around as a possible VP. And if he sees his numbers really dropping, and, you know, he didn't believe the polls in 2016, which was correct because, well, the national polls were correct. Hillary Clinton in popular vote did just about exactly what the national polls suggested. But a couple of states had the polls wrong. Excuse me. But those states, Michigan elected a Democratic governor, Wisconsin elected a Democratic governor. And so those are two out of the three states that Trump won that nobody thought he would win. So that's a big indicator. And they elected a woman in Michigan and a man in Wisconsin. So when you think about that dynamic, peeling away of those very slim margins he won by in 2016 in those states, you think it's a tougher electoral map for Donald Trump. And that's why you start to think he'll probably, Indiana went really solid Republican, and you don't need Pence for Indiana. Indiana seems to be Trump country now. So why keep Pence when you can pick up Nikki Haley and possibly win some of those suburban women voters back in those key states that you need?
How do you think that translates? We obviously have a very different situation here in Rhode Island than on the national spectrum, where it's essentially a monolithic Democratic Party. The factions within the party almost function in the way that the two-party system functions at the national level in a very vague manner. But do you feel like Republicans as a brand are so damaged by the national activities, if you will, of Donald Trump, just the rhetoric alone, that we're now going to see going forward in Rhode Island, some of the Nick Mattiello style Democrats become sort of define themselves as the new right and allow for progressives to become sort of the standard left?
You know, I'm not persuaded that that can happen as quickly as you're suggesting, only because, you know, when the economy is good, these questions can be discussed and people can get all wrapped up in them, a lot of different people. And now the city council's poised with the question of overriding. You have to expect that, you know, there's already requirements about having workers of color, minority set-asides, in other words, to have a certain percentage of jobs go to people of color. My guess is that that will be the deal that is struck with the construction companies and the developer in order to win some of those votes from people from South Providence, for example, on the project, then that will go through, I would imagine. So when you think about that, you see Democrats fighting with each other, but not based on these broad sort of left-right dimensions, but basically how do we keep the economy in good shape? And the warning signs are starting to come. Retail's slowing, inventory's going up, manufacturing jobs are going down. You have to be careful about the economy. And that's where Trump's policies, you can argue, are really having a negative impact on the economy. So the double whammy for the Republicans is even even if Trump gets quieter and has better rhetoric, if he continues on this path economically, he could really do some damage. And then if that damage persists for another year, you go into the 2020 election pretty vulnerable if you're a Republican.
What do you think the 2020 and 2022 picture looks like in Rhode Island as far as, you don't have to name any specific names, but do you feel like there's going to be some new players involved, or are we going to see we've got a pretty thick bench here, if you will?
Amongst the Democrats, I think there's a fairly strong bench for governor. For example, you have to expect that people like Dan McKee, who's lieutenant governor, Nelly Gorbea, the Secretary of State, and then Seth Magaziner, the treasurer, will probably be vying against each other in a primary for governor. That's what you sort of have to expect for the landscape. Alan Fung may run again. It's unclear. And Bob Flanders may run again for governor rather than senator. So I see some landscape being pretty filled with Democrats. And if we get redistricted in 2022 and we lose a congressional seat, then you're going to have Langevin against Cicilline probably running, and other people may get in as well. And a statewide race for a Republican might actually be more advantageous for a congressional seat than these divided two districts that we have. So that could get much more complicated as well.
Right. You wonder if Alan Fung would run for Congress.
Exactly. Alan Fung might run for Congress. Flanders might run for governor. So I think that's what you're looking at. And there's, I think also Nick Mattiello may decide he wants to run for something. And you never know what that may be. You don't know if a Democrat wins 2020. Jack Reed may be tapped to be Secretary of Defense. It's always been a big rumor, but I think it becomes more likely. It's possible Gina Raimondo gets tapped to do something. She said she's going to fill out her term, but one never knows. Right. And that will change the landscape going into 2022 as well. And of course, how Rhode Island grows smart. You know, do we continue to sustain this sort of small business focus and think about tech and art and innovation and startups, thinking about being a great place to live and trying to attract more people to come to the state? If that trend continues, then the economy will hold. And I think those in power will benefit from that.
Kind of going to a contemporary issue right now. It certainly is not just happening right now. It's just that the results are coming out on these standardized tests statewide. Obviously, you work in higher education and you work in very much so higher education. At the same time, I'm sure you have a spectrum of people who come even from within Rhode Island that come through. Do you feel that by and large, aside from standardized tests, kids in Rhode Island are ready for the challenges that whatever this new world is we're heading towards will present? So as all that innovation takes place in this state, do we have the talent pool here?
I think we have the talent pool in Rhode Island. I mean, Jorge Lores as mayor actually points out that every kid in Providence City Schools has access to computers, and that's a huge deal. And I think that even the fact that kids spend so much time on their phones makes them more computer savvy and more literate than their parents and their grandparents. And I think there's a hunger to learn in this state and a hunger to work. I think people want to work here. And I think if you target your, particularly post-secondary, after you get out of high school, if you're not ready for college, if there's enough opportunities to get training, a business, private-public partnership between businesses, or just putting state money into training, I think we can be as competitive as anywhere, particularly Vermont, New Hampshire, Maine. There's no question in New England we're competitive, and Connecticut's been having problems, so I think we can take advantage of that.
Yeah, it's about, I guess, just rethinking what vocational training means. It's not sort of like, all right, we're going to put you here because you're clearly not going to URI, which to me, that's how it was presented when I went to Cherahoe and graduated in 2002. It was sort of like, well, if you're not good at what we need you to be good at, we'll put you at this other thing we could use you for. Now it seems like industries, it's almost working backwards. What do we specifically need in terms of skills and the way brains function?
Right. And also, I think that vocational education has been incredibly underfunded, just dramatically underfunded. Since Ronald Reagan cut vocational education in block grant form in the early to mid-1980s, and George Herbert Walker Bush didn't put it back, Clinton didn't put it back, because then the Democrats decided everybody should go to college. And so it became a liberal progressive thing to make college more accessible, but not everybody is ready for college at 18, and not everybody wants to be in college. And it's not just the cost else it's prohibitive. It's just the type of learning you do. And nobody in the Democratic Party has really been willing to go back and say, this is what we need to do. I think Gina Raimondo has actually been a leader in that and saying, not everybody's ready. Let's make sure that if you are, you can go to CCRI for free. But if not, there's other opportunities for you, and we will target your training towards what businesses need. And I think that's absolutely right. But, you know, even to be a machinist, to be a tool person now, you have to know computers, because computers are actually doing so much of what machines or, you know, used to, or people used to do. So that training is going to be across the board necessary in manufacturing and what we used to call blue collar jobs as much as it is white collar jobs.
Yeah. And we heard some people speak of this, certainly the governor's proposals and what she's doing with CCRI. Mm-hmm. There's been some negative pushback on that, that this encourages people who aren't ready to go to college to go to college. But I don't know. I have no idea how you solve that. I think Dr. Luis Daniel Munoz's ideas about training both high school students and adults in vocational areas makes a lot of sense to me in that answering that question, maybe more so than everybody goes to CCRI. But I don't know the numbers. I have no idea if everyone's going to CCRI.
Right. I mean, we know that there's been an increase in enrollment in CCRI, and there's also been more attrition because people are going. But I do think offering people a glimpse of what higher education can give you, and also just shoring up your skills that maybe you did or didn't get in high school, and doing that for free. You can do it at night. You can do it on the weekends. You can do it, I think, online. I think that's crucial to bring the state more, to making the state more modern, and making sure that we have a workforce that employers are going to want to come to Rhode Island and hire. So it's still a really good investment, even if it has a bumpy out, you know, growing pains in the next couple of years. And I think you're again, so right to point out, providing more opportunity for people is always a good path. And particularly for the Democrats, they think government or government institutions can do that. And the Republicans say, no, private businesses can do that. And what I think Gina Raimondo's approach has been, let's do both at the same time. And we'll see, you know, what the longer term impacts are. We know, unfortunately, that worker retraining after the age of 55 doesn't work, that people just, it's a really hard thing to learn new things at that age. And that's the big concern I have, is an aging population, and then people who lose their jobs in their 50s before they can get Medicare, the federal medical health insurance program, which you can't get till you're 65. You can't get Social Security now till you're about 65, given the way they've bumped up the retirement age. And that's a great concern for Rhode Island, because we do have a population in that bubble that could be damaged if there's an economic downturn.
Do you feel that not only Brown University, but and not only universities, colleges and universities, but private institutions in the state, whether it be hospitals or businesses, universities and colleges, do you feel like you all are working together in a way to develop that workforce, not just in the sense of, you know, holding events or disseminating information, but do you feel like there's communication between organizations right now from your perspective, kind of with these longer term goals and all the different players you'd need to get involved?
That's a fantastic question, but it really should be directed towards different people at Brown, because yeah. I don't know the answer to that. I know that there are individual programs at Brown, the Swearer Center for Engaged Service and Public Service, and I know that we participate in Year Up. I think there's a lot of places where we do public-private partnership, and we do try to train more people and invite them more in, but I don't know how much the different institutions actually coordinate this as joint programs. Yep. You know, Rhode Island, URI's nursing program and Brown worked together to develop the old Heritage Museum, and that's a fantastic development. And now you see that there's a big apartment building right there, and then there's more building with the Wexford company coming in. So in that area, I think you're seeing that universities and health establishments are trying to economize and share space and develop properties together, because there's synergy there. And I think that's something you have to think about beyond Providence. Where else can we do that? Pawtucket, to me, is a perfect and prime example of where I think people should be thinking about development, certainly now losing the postdocs in the future, and thinking about really having the jobs that were in Pawtucket or may be lost in Pawtucket, the hospital. And that's really great prime real estate. It just needs some development. And so you wonder if the state is going to be coordinated about that.
Yeah, Pawtucket's a big factor in all of that for sure, especially post-PawSox. It's amazing what a minor league baseball team, the challenges that presented and potentially distraction it presented in a way, you know, considering how much energy went into it this year.
Yeah, it was. It consumed a lot of energy, and I think it's really sad to lose a landmark. I mean, I do. I think Green's been amazing. The mayor of Pawtucket, you couldn't find a stronger advocate for Pawtucket than that mayor. He's been phenomenal. And I do think there's a lot to be developed there. And the question is, in terms of recruiting businesses and thinking about transportation and thinking about living, and, you know, there are good restaurants in Pawtucket. So how do you make Pawtucket sort of like the way Providence was resurrected 20 years ago? And I think there's a lot of opportunity there.
Yeah, especially with the train. And I actually was in Central Falls City Hall yesterday, and obviously they're essentially an extension of Pawtucket in an economic sense. But you get the sense that that's their goal as well. I even asked Mayor Diosa, are you concerned about gentrification? And frankly, he seemed to be willing to have that happen, to bring in people from Boston, even if it means displacing residents from the city.
Yeah, I think you've got to be really careful about that and be really sure that you're not pushing people out the door and that there are places for them to live and there's affordable housing available. But there is a lot of opportunity there. And particularly Boston housing prices are so expensive. And here we can actually become a place where one person can work in Providence or, you know, South Providence or Pawtucket, and one person can work in Boston in terms of a family. And then you have to work on the schools at the same time. And I think that's always a chronic problem for a lot of areas. But that's something that the state is investing in now. They'll have to fix crumbling schools. And when you fix your infrastructure and you build up the properties a little bit around the infrastructure, then hopefully you can rebuild communities.
What would you say is the biggest challenge facing political science, the humanities as a whole right now? It's not under attack in the way that journalists are under attack right now. But you get the sense that a lot of times there's obviously a history of a liberal strain in a lot of academia. It's there, but at the same time, the fundamental bias, that's the debate.
I teach a lot of students in my lecture classes. They're pretty big, and there's a big swath of people come from all over the country, all over socioeconomic backgrounds, racial, ethnic, gender preference, gender sexual identity. I think it's, you know, a much more diverse community. There is a reputation, I think, for Brown to be more liberal than most. I mean, Dartmouth is more conservative. Brown's more liberal. It's elite. There's no question about that as well. But it's also mostly interested in getting at the core questions that drive humanity and how do you make the system better. What I've been so encouraged about from URI and Providence College and Rhode Island College, RISD, Brown, all of the schools, Rhode Island Community College, the younger generation seems to be more engaged than they have in the past. Their numbers went up a little bit in voting, not as much as you would have liked to see, but certainly a real understanding of what the stakes are, from climate change to Social Security to entitlements to education to gun control. They seem to understand that if you get out the door and you support candidates and you vote or you mobilize or you march or you do all those things, that change will come. And I think that was the most important thing about the Democrats winning the House back and winning now, as of today, 40 seats, which is a fairly big margin to win in one election. It's the biggest one since Watergate for the Democrats. That just tells young people that if you get out the door, things will change. And that is the message that I think, whether you're liberal or conservative, that is the message you want, because that will sustain the democracy.
As far as the media in Rhode Island, the political media, you're a member of that. You appear on A Lively Experiment quite frequently. Also, it's now The Public's Radio.
I talk to Gene Valsenti on WPRO on Tuesday mornings at 7:40. So I run the gamut from talk radio to Channel 10 to Live Experiment.
It's amazing. Do you feel like I sense that we have a very good local media here in terms of the characters who are out there working in front of the camera, behind the scenes, whatever it may be. It's, you know, we saw a Ted Nesi, Dan McGowan national piece yesterday, I think, that came out. Hey, look at these guys. They're covering local stories in depth, looking at these problems. Do you feel like that's a huge ally to academics, artists? We're all kind of in it together to try to save the world, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think Channel 10 has, you know, Parker Gavigan, Bill Rapley, it has Gene Valsenti, obviously, and Patrice Wood, and I think and Katie Davis. You have those people at Channel 10. We do have a really, really excellent Kathy Gregg at Providence Journal. You have and Patrick Anderson, you have Ferment, and Jim Hommel, obviously, for Live Experiment. You have people who really care about politics. They're Rhode Islanders. They're here. They've been here a long time. They're very vested in this community, and they care a lot, and they ask a lot of really great questions. And I still feel like an interloper, and I've been here 24 years. Yeah. So I think that's a great thing for the state of Rhode Island. I think the political coverage is way above average across the country in Rhode Island than in any other state. I think the politicians get tired of the aggressiveness, which is excellent. That's what you want the politicians to feel, that they're having to answer too many questions. So I do think we have, but I'm concerned about it, right? You've got to support public radio. You've got to support public television. The Providence Journal is getting thinner and thinner. And you really start to worry what will happen if these organizations aren't supported by the populace. How are we going to figure out what's going on?
Yeah, it's going to be a completely different way to obtain information. We've already sort of hinted at that with narrowcasting over the last few decades. But at some point, you may have different sectors of people getting completely different sets of news stories every day and not having that common factor of, hey, something happened in the world.
Yeah, I don't see very many young people reading the newspaper physically. I think that's going to unfortunately eventually go away, and that is sad. But they do read the newspaper digitally,
sure.
And they read it on their phone. They read it everywhere. So they are consuming a lot of news. But again, you've got this whole news feed. You have Stitcher podcasts. You have RSS. You have all these news feeds that cull or, you know, put together, aggregate news articles for you. And that's a little bit scary. Even Instagram might be starting to do that, or yep. Snapchat. And that's scary. Facebook obviously has already done it because it funnels the news. And the beauty of a newspaper is as you flip through the pages, you actually, your eye catches different stories. You're forced to read about things you wouldn't necessarily select. And that is the big change between newspapers and print and digital.
As always, thank you for listening to the Bartholomew Town Podcast. Until next time, I'm Bill Bartholomew. We'll talk soon.
At HealthSource RI for Employers, we provide access to health insurance to more than 1,100 local businesses and nonprofits, and 96% of them renew through us every year. Maybe it's our choice of 19 different health plans, our 10 years of customizing solutions, or our one local team of dedicated experts helping employers find quality health insurance. See how our numbers stack up for you. Learn more at healthsourceri.com/employers.